Gonzalez will be submitted on the briefs. So the court will turn to the fourth case of the day, Davis versus Unum Life Insurance. Mr. Brunschleicher?
Good morning. I represent the defendant, which is the cross appellant in this case. I understand that, according to the calendar, the cross appellant was scheduled to go first. I represent Unum Life Insurance Company of America and the Regal Beloit Corporation Long Term Disability Plan. This case involves a straightforward application of principles of deferential judicial review under ERISA. Mr. Davis's claim was initially approved on the basis of a psychiatric condition, and under the plan that has a 24-month maximum pay period, and that pay period was paid 1 year after Mr. Davis ceased working. He claimed to be disabled by multiple physical conditions. The treating physicians of Mr. Davis simply disagree in this case. One set of treating physicians, including Mr. Davis's endocrinologist and a neurologist, on whom Unum relied, determined that Mr. Davis's weakness and cognitive issues were primarily psychogenic and related to a psychiatric condition. They also determined that Mr. Davis's physical symptomatology of weakness and instability were exaggerated and had a psychogenic component. The second set of treating physicians, an internist and a neurologist on whom Mr. Davis relied, acknowledged that none of Mr. Davis's physical medical conditions are of themselves disabling. They opined nonetheless that the physical conditions combine to create disability. Medical evidence in the administrative record supports both sets of treating physicians' views. However, only the first set of treating physicians on whom Unum relied considered and evaluated Mr. Davis's psychiatric records.
There are a lot of doctors in this. Are they, these two people that were, I won't call them on your side, but you relied on, was that Reich and Levy?
The set that Unum relied on is Dr. Reich and Dr. Levy. Yes. The internist and neurologist that Mr. Davis relied on with respect to the physical disability is Dr. Raymond and Dr. Myers. Dr. Raymond and Dr. Myers, however, failed to consider and evaluate the psychiatric records. They therefore failed to consider an important aspect of the problem, which is mental illness versus physical disability. It was within Unum's discretion to choose among the competing opinions of the treating physicians. And in exercising its discretion, Unum reasonably and permissibly consulted its in-house medical experts, including an orthopedic surgeon, a psychiatrist, a psychologist, an internist, and a specialist in physical medicine and rehabilitation. The in-house physicians determined that Mr. Davis's physical conditions had resolved, were well controlled with medication, were produced by a psychiatric condition, or had been misdiagnosed based on objective medical tests provided by the treating physicians. The district court, however, in its memorandum opinion, failed to give deference to Unum's reasonable and permissible choice. The district court penalized Unum for consulting its in-house physicians on the basis that in-house physicians are not truly independent, and that was an improper credibility determination on the part of the district court. In addition, the district court improperly weighed the evidence of the treating physicians. The district court determined that Dr. Raymond accepted Dr. Raymond's diagnosis and Dr. Myers' diagnosis, the treating physicians on whom Davis relies, without question, and imposed upon Unum a burden of explaining why they disagreed with their opinions. And that was improper under the Supreme Court's ruling in Nord. Under Nord, if a decision of an administrator who has discretion is supported by substantial medical evidence, the administrator does not have a burden of explaining why it accepts one set of medical opinions over a differing set of medical opinions. So it was inappropriate and an improper and a failure to apply NORD by the district court. A review of this case shows that Unum's in-house physicians reviewed the entire medical history of the plaintiff and considered his psychiatric as well as his physical problems. And in doing so, they accepted and adopted the medical opinions of Drs. Reich and Drs. Levy, who performed extensive testing on Mr. Davis. The decision clearly reflects a reasonable and permissible choice among conflicting medical opinions. On this basis, defendants contend that the decision of the district court was erroneous and that summary judgment should have been entered in favor of the defendants. And I'll reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal.
Thank you. Mr. Dabowski.
May it please the court, counsel. My name is Mark Dabowski. I represent William Davis, the plaintiff and appellant in this matter. Counsel just made the same argument that the district court thoroughly and correctly rejected in issuing summary judgment in favor of Mr. Davis. This is not a situation where the court weighed the evidence. The district court found that Unum's decision was arbitrary and capricious on five separate grounds. The defendant relied on conclusory and unsupported opinions of in-house doctors who did not examine the plaintiff, relied on in-house opinions without any explanation for any basis of disagreement with Drs. Raymond and Dr. Myers.
When you say conclusory, what do you mean? Let me tell you what my problem is with the way the district court proceeded. The district court seems to want physicians to write like lawyers. And that's not normally what physicians do. If you go to a physician for a diagnosis or a treatment, the physician doesn't write like a lawyer. The physician will write some scrawl, which is barely readable, on the theory that his time is very valuable, and leave it to somebody else to write long explanations. What is it about ERISA that says if the physicians don't write explanations that read as if they came from lawyers, then the decision must be arbitrary and capricious?
I don't agree with your premise, Your Honor. And I think if we go back to the 1992 decision of this court in Halpin versus Granger, this court made it very clear that plan administrators are obligated to give a rationale for their opinions. But what happened in this case is that
the rationale may be we've sent this person to, or we've looked at the opinions of three physicians, and they say he's not disabled. A perfectly intelligible rationale. And then that leads the district court to look back at the opinions, the statements by the physicians. And she finds that the statements by the physicians are summary. Physicians give their bottom line, but not a lengthy, or indeed maybe any, explanation that a layman can understand.
It's more than that, Your Honor. What happened in this case is that here we have Dr. Myers explaining that Mr. Davis is disabled because he has the stroke and the spinal stenosis superimposed on the polio. He has to use a walker to ambulate, and nowhere does Unum address that issue. Dr. Raymond talks about the carpal tunnel syndrome and the inability to write. Nowhere does Unum address that. In fact, Unum pretends that the opinion doesn't even exist. Dr. Fluter writes in his report, after receiving Dr. Raymond's report, no new evidence has been provided. This is simply Unum treating the evidence in this case like an ostrich. They're pretending it doesn't exist, and they're repeating the same mantra again and again.
I must say, if we did this, if there were a trial, and three witnesses said X and three witnesses said not X, and we were asked to summarize the evidence on appeal, we would summarize the evidence, only the evidence in favor of the verdict. We wouldn't try to summarize the other evidence, we wouldn't try to evaluate, and we certainly wouldn't restate it. Would that mean we were behaving like an ostrich?
Not at all. But the issue is far different here. Here we have a situation where Mr. Davis is applying for disability benefits, applying to an insurance company he thinks is going to fairly evaluate his claim, and they choose to simply ignore the evidence that he's submitting and not give any reason for disagreeing with that evidence.
As we're coming back to this question about what these people have to do, we could adopt rules that require physicians to write longer opinions, insurance companies to write longer opinions, but workers are in the end going to have to pay the cost. This raises the price of insurance. That comes out of workers in the end. It doesn't come out of shareholders. You're asking us to do something that in the end workers may regret. I mean, private insurers don't do this. Just skip ERISA. If I make a claim against my Blue Cross plan, Blue Cross isn't going to write me an opinion. I'm going to get a computer-generated form because they're desperate to hold down administration costs. And the argument here is that in ERISA cases, we should be driving up administration costs.
Absolutely not. But I think the difference in the example that you gave, Your Honor, is that if you applied to Blue Cross for benefits, for life-saving treatment, and Blue Cross denied that treatment to you, and you ended up in litigation with Blue Cross, you would have an opportunity to test the opinions that Blue Cross relied on in denying your benefits. We have a situation here where a claimant is up against a wall, an impenetrable wall, where this court has given rules that he's not allowed to get any information whatsoever to challenge the basis or look into the rationale behind the reasons that were given for the denial. And this court, the district court, properly pointed out and threw the gauntlet down at Unum by saying, no case has found a decision properly supported where there's been no independent review, no examination, no consultation with the treating physician.
Mr. Ross, and I know you and I have in another case have discussed this area recently. If there was just a mention of the two doctors and the doctors that you just referred to who had a contrary, or you know, the carpal tunnel and the evidence. What was the other? The spine.
Spinal stenosis.
Yes. If there's just a mention that those doctors' reports were reviewed, would that be sufficient? In other words, so that if the administrator said they were looked at as well as the others, and would that, in your view, indicate that they had considered it?
I don't think so. And I would add that particularly given the background of this case, where Unum has been investigated by multiple government agencies, where there is really reason to suspect the reliability of their opinions, and where this court has stated in Haichu versus AIG that independent review is the hallmark of a full and fair review, that just reciting that the records were looked at is not going to be enough to sustain a decision on something as important as employee benefits when Congress has decreed that the ERISA law was intended for the protection of plan participants, not for the protection of the insurance companies who are denying these benefits.
Well, if we had an opinion that said that the doctor's report, as labeled, is insufficient, would the next step be just identifying what they found, and again, would that be sufficient? In other words, without any analysis other than the conclusion that of a someone like Unum that we're going to rely on our three doctors. I'm just trying to get what level would trigger the kind of examination that you feel is necessary, and to balance that against, you know, the kinds of concerns that Judge Easterbrook has expressed.
I think saying insufficient is just not going to cut the mustard, because there's no way for the claimant, particularly given the current regime where no discovery is allowed, is going to have any basis to know whether that's a legitimate medical opinion or an opinion given by a doctor who has a financial incentive to write that. And that's the problem with these ERISA cases, and that's also the problem with the remand in this case, that we have an order sending this case back to a company which has already decided that they're not going to pay any attention to the evidence supporting Mr. Davis's disability. Time has passed. We're now 4 years later, and there's no way that a doctor at Unum is going to be able to look at the case now and say, other than, well, he might be disabled now, but we don't know if he was disabled in 2002, so we're going to uphold our denial on that basis, and then it is going to be immune from review. And this court has cautioned in the Daberton case the concern about sending the case back again for an opportunity for the defendant to come up with just the right reason to sustain review a second time.
Well, she wants to send it back again and hope and the suggestion that there will be what I guess is an independent doctor. Her main complaint was that these were, I guess, what do you call them, in-house or something or other, but six of them. And in addition to Drs. Reich and Levy, which were his doctors, the court came up with what at least has to be referred to as substantial medical evidence. And we are under an arbitrary and capricious standard where there is discretion, and they've exercised it, and it seems that with our standard of review, the judge went the other way and kept practically looked at the same things you're talking about. The guy's in bad shape, and therefore this can't be right. And that's what it comes down to, and I don't think that's our standard of review.
I think that it is our standard of review, Your Honor. I think that this court has repeatedly stated that the arbitrary and capricious standard of review is not a rubber stamp, and there has to be a logical connection between the evidence and the decision that's made.
Substantial evidence.
I'm sorry.
No.
Mr. Bossi, is your concern on remand that it'll go back, the doctor's reports will be mentioned in more detail? I mean, you're the claimant's doctors, and all we'll get is the same?
That's one of my concerns, and the other concern is even if Mr. Davis is sent out for an examination by an independent physician, it's now 4 years later. And even if that physician finds Mr. Davis disabled today, Unum can argue his coverage ended when we found him not disabled, so it doesn't really matter. And that's one of the dangers with the course of time that passes through litigation, whereas this court has said repeatedly, most recently in the Hackett case, that the plan remains free to re-adjudicate the claim later. And that would be fine. But to go back now and try and reinvent the wheel is going to be too difficult at this point. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Bowski. Ms. Menschlichter.
Just a few brief points. With regard to the issue of conclusory opinions, this is not an instance where the in-house physicians checked off a box or provided merely their ipse dixit opinion. They indicated the evidence they relied on. The plaintiff argues that he's disabled by a stroke, but the diagnosis was transient ischemia. There's the objective medical evidence establishes no stroke. The spinal stenosis is documented by MRIs, and a comparative study was done indicating that that did not spiral out of control. So the conclusions are well-founded and are reasonably based upon the medical evidence. With regard to the conflict issue, what really is occurring here and what I think occurred in the district court is an improper application, an improper decision that there was a conflict of interest based on the inherent conflict, and that's been rejected by this court. There's no evidence that the doctors who were consulted by Unum in-house had received jiggered incentives in order to deny a claim, or that they sold out their...
Weren't we just supplied by Mr. Dabowski with a district court opinion that indicates there are incentives connected with Unum life insurance?
Well, those actually...
I mean, I don't know that it happened in this case, but the company does incentivize.
The court is referring to the district court opinion, which is a discovery order in Tennessee.
Yes, the Bennett versus the Bennett
case. That is not a finding that there was a conflict of interest. There are no findings there. It's a discovery order, and it's insufficient to force Unum to wear a scarlet letter that it has a conflict of interest that it has to bear in every court forum. I don't think there's any evidence in this record that the individual physicians who decided this claim in-house received incentives to deny the claim rather than to grant it.
So your position is nothing in this record, but you're not prepared to say that these physicians weren't incentivized. You just don't know.
I can only speak to the record in this case.
Sure.
Yes. And I can also speak outside the record and say that these physicians do not receive financial incentives to deny claims. If the court reads that Tennessee case, they'll notice that the testimony comes from the situation in 1995 and 1996. In fact, Unum pays 98% of all of its claims. That's not a conflict of interest. Thank you.
Our thanks to both counsel. The case is taken under advisement.